Study tonight on building a partnership. Tonight will be part four of that. And last Wednesday night we talked about in a marital relationship, and I suppose even if you, what we used to call courting way back in the day, that's dating me pretty huge. I think, is it dating now? Or you're exclusive now? What do y'all call it when y'all are dating somebody and you're not married to them? What do you call that? Okay, no one knows then. We'll just move on. So
I know you can put it on social media.
You can put taken or no longer available or I'm not interested in you anymore or something like that. I don't do social media either. But anyway, I think you get the point. But last Wednesday night, we talked about sources of conflict. We talked about the uniqueness of the marital relationship and the husband and wife. We talked about acceptance. And we talked about some facts about conflict, that they are inevitable. Has anybody found that to be true that's been married for any length of time? Sense of unfulfilled needs and so on. We talked about opportunities for growth and possible sources of stress in marriage and the family unit. Tonight I want to continue that. And I've opted not to teach one of these lessons in its entirety on Wednesday night. We'd be here for probably an hour or more. But we're breaking them up into pieces, and I'm trying to find a good stopping point. So if I can just pick up where I left off last Wednesday night, I want to talk to you for a little while tonight about reactions to conflict. When you have conflict in the home, in your marriage, or it could even pass on to children, your children. I want to talk to you for a little while tonight about reactions to conflicts. I'm going to talk to you about controlling negative emotions, and then we'll end tonight on the biblical regimen of the home that God intends. I have announced two or three times, and I'll remind you that this material that I'm teaching is very old-fashioned and it's very biblical. Be honest with you, Sister Murphy and I have been married almost 42 years. We've been married 42 years in November. And I just don't find in younger married couples that I counsel with pretty often that all these newfangled ideas work too well. Because y'all divorced more than we did. I'm still married to my first wife. Now, don't read into that. I don't have a second and third either, so I just wanted to clear that up and make sure you understood. So let's jump into this. We know tonight that every relationship has its share of conflict. And I think just by the single fact that you put a male and a female in a relationship, just on the sole identities of the two people, one being male, the other being female, that just has conflict written all over it, right? And then you add to that personalities. You add to that personal desires. You add to that the way both of them grew up and how they were raised. You add to that how much baggage they're bringing into that marital relationship. And you just have all kind of things thrown in the pot in marriage that can create a little bit of conflict now and then. And I know most of you folks here tonight never have had any conflict in your marriage. But the two or three of us that have and had, I'll talk to you for a little while tonight. In a relationship and in our reaction to conflict, when there is disagreement, there's going to be. So when there is disagreement, it is necessary to respect each other's opinions and ideas about the subject matter on which you are disagreeing. It's important and it's necessary to respect each other's opinions. And I think we approach conflict, most husbands and wives will approach conflict with the basic attitude or the premise going into the conflict that I'm right, they're wrong. We go into the conflict that mindset, and so when you are persuaded, and when you're approaching a conflict, and you know one's coming, if you approach it with that attitude, you're going to make it very difficult to resolve. to go in with the I'm right posture, and everybody does it. But if you want to be fair in marital relationship, we have to understand that the two people involved in that marriage, the husband and wife, they have a right to their opinion. I have a right to mine. Sister Murphy has a right to hers. I look over here at Mark and Brianna, or Dallas and Brianna. I wish I could get y'all's names switched around or something. Got a Brianna and a Brianna, and I get them, one of them turned around all the time. But I look over here at them. They have a perfect marriage, I know, and they've never had any conflict or nothing, but it's because Brianna's already convinced him that she's right about everything, so that's how they have the perfect. Is that right? Is that how that works? I'm picking on them tonight. You're welcome. So, Mark and Brianna. But everybody has a right to their own opinion. Everybody has a right to their own ideas. And believe it or not, everybody has a right to their own attitude. Right or wrong, everybody has a right to their own attitude, and everybody has a right to their own convictions. This is a part of the marital identity that we've talked about. When you get married, your spouse does not lose their identity, and neither do you lose yours. And God designed it that way. So when there's a conflict, we need to remind ourselves that our spouse has their own opinion. They have a right to have their own opinion. They have a right to their own ideas, attitudes, and convictions. And this is a part of the identity of the husband and wife in marriage. So our attitude should allow our spouse the right of thinking for themselves. They have a God-given right to do that. I want to have everybody understand here tonight.
If you're married, or you're thinking about getting married,
marriage is not reform school. And I think we all need to remember that. It is not an opportunity for one person to change another person into what they think that person ought to be, or to change that person into something that will suit them the best. Every person on this planet has a right to be an individual. And I have some more news to present to you about marriage. As no human being is going to stay the same after 5 years of marriage. After 10 years of marriage. I'll tell you one thing that happens when people get married. They just blow up like a balloon, except for Dallas. I mean, they just... The first year I was married, I got married when I weighed about 140 pounds. And the first year I married, I shot up to 180. And all I could say was I was just giving Sister Murphy my love. So one who is honest and motivated by love will change his own characteristics to be better for his spouse or with his spouse. They'll do it on their own. But when you as a spouse attempt to summarily change your spouse into someone you think they ought to be, you're inviting a whole lot of conflict and difficulty into your marriage. Each spouse will accept the other's normal traits and characteristics and give consideration to them in their everyday communication. So when conflicts arise, and they will, we have several ways of reacting to them.
When conflict arises, we have several ways of reacting to them.
If y'all folks can put the graphic on the screen. I've got this nifty little laser pointer, but it's also like a taser. It's a laser slash taser. So when you get up and walk out, I can just pop that on you. And you'll just fall out on the floor and shaking and trembling. I'm kidding. I wish sometimes it would do that, but it doesn't. Okay. If you'll look at the screen here tonight, you'll notice in the box here, the rectangle, that we have five words in here, and I hope everybody can see that. Yield, resolve, compromise, withdraw, win. Those are five basic ways or methods you can choose to resolve conflict. But the big thing about conflict in a marriage is when you look at the approach to resolving it or reacting to it, there's going to always be a motive behind it.
When you have conflict and you want to react
to that conflict, it is extremely rare that you're not going to go into that conflict without some motive or another. What I want you to consider tonight, whether you're in a conflict in your marriage and whether you choose to yield or resolve or compromise, withdraw, or win, what you have to consider is the motive. You see that on all four sides of this rectangle? So, for example, if you want to go into a conflict and you have to win, you have to be the winner, then usually it's indicative of the fact that you have low concern for your marriage or you have very high concern for your personal goal. You want to come out on top for a reason. You want to win that conflict for a reason. If you see the word resolve here up in the corner, if you want to resolve the issue, it would typically mean you have a high concern for your personal goals and the personal goals of your marriage, or you have a high concern for your marriage relationship as a whole. To yield, you have a high concern for your marriage relationship or a low concern for personal goals. To withdraw, you have a low concern for your personal goals and a low concern for marriage relationships. Do y'all see that? If you throw the word in the corner and apply both sides it is connected to, it'll kind of give you a typical average motivation that married couples have when they want to react or resolve a conflict. If you look at the word compromise right here in the middle, typically when you compromise, you're not really thinking necessarily about any of these things. Compromise isn't always bad, but it's not always good. It depends on what you're compromising. So let's begin tonight with the word withdrawal. Should be in the bottom left-hand corner of the rectangle. And what you want to consider when I just go through this very brief thing about withdrawing from a conflict is either you have a low concern for your personal goals or you have a low concern for your marriage when you withdraw. I'm not going to talk about it. I'm just going to walk away. I'm not going to deal with it. So if you have a tendency to view conflict in your marriage as a hopeless inevitability, which you can do little to control, you may not even try to resolve it. I know this is so evident in marriages, particularly where the other spouse has habits or traits that are repetitive and have been repetitive for years. After a while, you just get tired of fussing about it. You just get tired of fighting it. So you just say whatever and you withdraw from it. You just throw white flags. I'm just not going to fool with it anymore. You may withdraw physically by leaving the scene, walking out of the room, or you may simply leave psychologically. You just tune the other person out and let them do their rant and rave and whatever they're going to do, and then you act as though nothing ever happened. You're withdrawing. So you can see from the diagram on the screen that this reaction has the lowest value because it gives up on achieving personal goals and it completely gives up on developing the marriage relationship. This reaction should only be used as a cooling off period before you make real effort or real attempt to resolve whatever conflict is in front of you. And conflict in marriage can go from anywhere from spending too much money at Walmart to cheating on your spouse. Conflict is conflict. And when conflict is in a marriage, they usually don't go away. You can sweep it under the rug, but sooner or later it's going to resurface. It's going to come back sooner or later. So to withdraw, you use that only to cool off, not get emotional, not get angry. You know, you're not going to write about this right now. Let's cool off and we'll talk about it tomorrow. That's where you would use withdrawal to cool off for a while and address it later. The second thing I want to talk to you about is moving over to the bottom right-hand corner of the rectangle is to win. If you feel like that you must always look after your own interest or your own self-image is being threatened by conflict, you may be the type of person that always has to win the argument. In other words, if I lose, then I'm going to diminish myself in the eyes of my spouse. They won't respect me. They won't love me. Or I will lose my own self-respect. I'll lose my own self-love that I will have for myself. Or you can lose interest in your own goals and what have you. So no matter what the cost, you must win. And I've seen marriages like this. Domination is usually reflected in the style with no regard for the welfare of the marriage relationship. I've known of spouses in times past where when they get into conflict, one of them, husband or wife, either one, they always have to win. They always have to be right. There is no room, none whatsoever, for them to ever be wrong, for them to ever need to apologize, for them to ever need to make it up. There's no room for that whatsoever. And when that is the case, that the spouse that does that is looking up for themselves. They must win. They may have personal goals, whether it's their personality or things at the job or whatever. They have personal goals that are more important to them than their marriage. The third thing that I will mention to you tonight is in the top left-hand corner of the rectangle, and that is yield. Sometimes we react to conflicts and you sometimes want to yield to the other person. All of us understand that when you're driving along the highway or approaching an intersection, hopefully you've noticed here and there sometimes a yield sign. And it simply means that you give in to the other person and you want to get along with them people. You don't want to provoke road rage by not yielding. The same is true in marriage. You can yield to the desires of your spouse. It's giving in to get along. It's another style of reacting to a conflict. You don't like it. I don't want to yield. I don't want to give in, but I'd rather get along. And this is sometimes where a dominant spouse will kind of continue to beat down the weaker spouse, if you will, not necessarily physically, but personality and so on. They'll continue to beat them down. And so the weaker spouse just throws their hands up. And I know people like this. They just throw their hands up and I just do whatever he wants to do. It's just easier. I just continually yield to my husband or I continually yield to my wife. It's another style of reacting to a conflict. So you don't like doing it. You would prefer not to do it. But rather than risk a confrontation, you choose to yield. This reaction places little or no value on you achieving what you want to achieve within yourself, but it does display a high concern for your marriage relationship. You just want peace in the home. You want some harmony. So it's just better to yield and give in to what your spouse should do. But it shows high concern for the marriage and low concern for personal goals. And then in the middle of the rectangle is compromise. And that's where you give a little to get a little. You bargain. You negotiate. It's called compromise. You may find that it is important to let up on some of your demands or ideas in order to help the other person give a little on their demands and ideas. And I've seen this happen in marriages numerous times. For example, if one spouse is just really dogmatic and just really determined that we want to go somewhere for a week and the other person don't go, well, a good compromise is just go half the week. And both parties get a little bit of what they want. They don't get everything they want, but they get a little bit of what they want. And it could be like buying a car, buying a house, what have you. Sometimes you compromise. And I think to compromise can be lost in the shuffle of all four of the motivators that you see going around the rectangle. But then you'll notice, finally, the last word we'll mention tonight is in the top right-hand corner, and it's the word resolve. And this is the ultimate A person may choose to resolve conflicts. A married couple may choose to resolve their conflict. And in this style of dealing with conflicts, a situation, an attitude, or behavior is changed by open and direct communication. And I want to say that so everybody understands it. If you choose to resolve a conflict, in this style of dealing with conflicts, a situation, an attitude, or a behavior is changed by open and direct communication. So naturally, this is a style with the highest value because the
relationship is strengthened
and personal goals are achieved as well when you choose the style or conduit of resolve to work out your conflicts in marriage. So I'm just giving you some tidbits here, and I hope it'll help somebody. If you'll take a picture of that box, or you might can get it from the media team when church is over if you want it. But it might be a good idea to study it some more and determine the next time you have a conflict in your marriage which style are you going to choose to resolve it. And if you choose that style, then you may want to consider, is this going to help the marriage or is it going to help me? And you need to weigh those things out when you approach conflict in marriage. I'm getting a stare from some of you older folks here tonight that you're like, been married 400 years, man. I'm just too tired and wore out to get through all this stuff. Well, it may be too late for you. But it's not too late for some of these younger folks. Oh, I'm teasing. I think it can apply to everybody. I think it can help everybody. Let me spend a few moments with you tonight, and thank you for the slide. Let me spend a few moments with you tonight on controlling negative emotions. And I'm convinced of it, in a marital relationship, this has to be the most difficult thing to do, is to learn how to control negative emotions. I've learned a long time ago, when people have conflict in marriage, when you begin to get emotional about it, you're losing ground bad. Because when you get emotional, you lose logic and you lose reason. Your voice gets louder and the words come out quicker. And there may even be a few names that come out, like, you stupid idiot, can't believe I married you. You're acting just like your parents, or, you know, whatever you want to say, whatever kind of slur or horrible thing you want to say. Those kind of things usually start. When you reach that point, it's time to stop. Because now you're saying things you're going to regret. Now you're saying things that's very hurtful. And it's time to just zip it. Yeah. Well, just shut your dumb mouth and wait till another day when you're in have a little better attitude and a little better spirit. I know that younger couples have a propensity to do this because they don't understand space yet. when you get married, you learn that your spouse loves you, but they need their space without you in it. And you have to learn that. And until you learn that, you're going to get yelled at and pushed away and shouted at and get off of me and get away from me and don't touch me and don't kiss me and don't hold my hand. And I found when you go to bed and you're angry, a king-size bed ain't wide enough. It's hard to control negative emotions. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that. Each of us is made up of negative and positive emotions. Everybody is. And I think everybody has buttons. I don't care how nice a person is. They have a button somewhere. And if you push it, they're going to go off on you. You know what I mean? Have you ever met these people? They're just stinking nice, man. They're so nice, they're not even real. They're like from another planet. They're from another species of humanity from somewhere. But somewhere, they've got a button. And if you push it, you're going to see a side of them that you regret seeing. I'm going to be honest with you. I've got one. There's two or three people here at Grace Church that's seen it. It's not good. It ain't pretty. And some of you have, but I'm being honest with myself. Y'all can sit there and look pious and sanctimonious on all you want me. Oh, no. I have the Holy Ghost. You may. But you didn't get rid of your humanity when you got it. So we're all made up of positive and negative emotions. So as we expose our true selves to each other, both the positive and the negative will come to the forefront. Mark and Brianna, has that happened to y'all yet? Never mind. We'll talk about that later. But we should be our true selves with each other. So our negative emotions can come out, and we can learn how to deal with each other in a very effective way. When the negative emotions are verbalized, a quarrel erupts. The mature person, everybody say the mature person. The mature person is able to control his or her emotions and does not allow his or her emotions to control them. A mature person can do that. And since marriage is, after all, for adults only, each spouse should have the ability to control his or her negative emotions if you are married and an adult and mature. Look at your neighbor and say, the man's right. Even if you disagree, I'm right. So if you can do this, if we can do this, this allows us to lay aside any feelings which are impure and displeasing to God's will in our marriage. I have to tell this story. I love to tell this story. Sister Murphy and I were married about a year. And I think it was about a year. And we lived in a little mobile home in the Jewel Road Trailer Park. I think it's out this direction somewhere. And our jobs worked out to where we only needed one car. I went to work earlier than she did and got off late than she did. Hence, I worked more than she did, longer hours than she did. All that. Anyway, so she would drop me off and pick me up. On the way to work, I don't know what we got in an argument, but it got ugly. And I finally played what I thought would be the most get rid of all this card you could play. I finally looked at her and said, "You are just like your mother." Now, I'm admitting I did that. Is there any other men here brazen and smart enough or brave enough to admit you? Not one other person, and I know others have done it. Well, when we got in the car to go to work, before the argument started, she fixed me a lunch, and I took it, and I put it right behind the driver's seat. We drove a two-door car at the time, and I just put it behind the driver's seat, and the plan was that when I got out of the car, I would pick up my lunch and go on into work because I wouldn't have a car at lunchtime, and I didn't feel like fasting that day. And so, man, we fussed and cussed at each other. Not cussed, but we fussed all the way to work. I do wish there were some Christian cuss words in moments like that that you could use, just some good Christian cuss words. And just come in handy on occasions. And But we didn't cuss. Didn't mean we weren't thinking it. We just didn't do it. But anyway, I got out of the car and didn't even say goodbye. Just slammed the door and into the office I went to go to work. About 20 minutes later, the secretary called me and said, "Can you come up to the front?" And I said, "Yeah, I came up there." And she said, "There's a little brown bag sitting there and out in the parking lot. Is that your lunch?" I love to tell that story. As mad as Sister Murphy was at me, she wasn't going to let me go hungry. She just picked my lunch up and just dropped it right there on the parking lot. And off she went. Y'all keep in mind, that happened 41 years ago. Neither one of us at that point knew how to control negative emotions. I could also tell you about the Wednesday night. We were at church and I was ready to go. I was tired. And she likes to visit after church, still does. And she'd make a great usher. She could turn the lights out every night at church. But anyway, I was ready to go. And so I thought I'd be the man of the house and I'd teach her a lesson. So I just left her at church. That didn't work out too good either. I just didn't do good when I first got married, man. I just walked from one landmine to the other. and just kept blowing myself. The reason was, is marriage is for adults only. That's why 10-year-olds don't get married. Even though there are people who might be 25-year-olds that still have the maturity level of a 10-year-old. You don't need to be getting married. Don't do it. Wait till you're a big boy. Wait till you're a big girl. And you can be mature and learn how to control your negative emotion. And the best way to control your negative emotions is to keep your dumb mouth shut and don't throw stuff. It doesn't help to throw stuff.
These idiots
come in and get mad at my wife and start throwing dishes. It never occurs to them. They're going to buy some more. They're not free. Y'all get the point. So let's talk about anger. Even the most mature partners in marriage are going to experience conflict. The Word of God allows for anger. Yes, it does. It's called righteous indigestion. Indignation. It's called righteous indignation. In Ephesians 4:26 and 27, you can get angry according to the Scripture, but there's three qualifications according to the Bible. There's three parameters that you have to stay in when you get mad. There's three parameters you can't cross when you get mad. Number one, the Bible says, sin not. Be angry and sin not so you don't cuss. And you don't throw stuff. And you don't call each other names. And you don't cop a bad attitude. Boy, it's hard to be a Christian and be married at the same time, ain't it? One has to go. Y'all having a good time here tonight. I'm having a good time. Number two, and I've been guilty of this. I still am guilty of this on occasions. The Bible said, do not let the sun go down on your wrath. Because your little sweetie next to you might die in her sleep or you might die in yours and you never get the opportunity to say, I'm sorry. But buddy, when you go to bed, fire blazing mad. It's just hard to roll over and say, I love you, honey, and I think you're wonderful and I forgive you and ask you to forgive me. You're actually hoping they do die in their sleep. But the Bible is, Sister Murphy said, y'all know how hard this is. She's sitting right there staring at me. Hard to teach this when your wife is in the same room. You think it's applicable to you. You ain't teaching it. But the Bible says to sin not. It says do not let the sun go down on your wrath. Number three, it says do not give place to the devil. You do not get angry and then go out and do something sinful or stupid. You don't do anything in your marriage that would give place to the devil. There's parameters to getting angry. And as long as you stay in those parameters, it's okay to get angry. But once you step outside of it, now you're sinning. And you're bringing spirits into your marriage. You're inviting spirits into your home, into your mind, into your marriage, into your relationship. Now you've got another battle to fight. So it's better most of the time to control your attitude, control your temper, keep your dumb mouth shut, and do what you know to do, and you'll be all right. Just obey the Bible. You'll be all right. So righteous indignation is not sin because it is directed toward a particular circumstance. It is not directed toward your spouse or yourself. You're not sinning when you're not hating. When you're not saving or hating your spouse or other family members,
personal type anger
is sin
and should not be expressed but cured. So when you're mad at yourself,
you don't have to express it, you cure it. So when you've done something stupid, change your behavior. Cure it. Expressing anger only transforms our experiences into bad habits. And we need to be aware of that. The spouse who is beginning to feel angry inside should report this emotion to his spouse. I couldn't say that without laughing. I've never done that before. I'm teaching something right here that I've never practiced. Buddy, when I get mad, I just get mad and I don't check in first. It happened to me Sunday. I got mad Sunday. And I just couldn't approach the situation just kind of easy. And it's hard when you're feeling angry on the inside to go sit down with your spouse and say, look, I'm getting really ticked off about this. You know, we need to. Y'all know what I mean? If you can do that, I'd like for you to teach me how. It's that hold everything moment. This is fixing to get real, real ugly. I'm teasing. There has been conflicts in my life that, in marriage and parenting, even in pastoring, where things are beginning to escalate. And when I realize it, I do the time out. Hey, whoa, whoa. Let's chill out for a minute. And I even do it with myself. I've told Sister Murphy on numerous occasions in our marriage, I'd rather not talk about this right now. Let me process. Let me just go through some stuff. And can we bring this up tomorrow? And she's done the same thing. It gives you time to cool off. It gives you time to get rid of all the emotional stuff. And then when you sit down and talk about the conflict, you can be reasonable. You can be logical. Don't ever forget, when you get emotional, 9 times out of 10, you're going to lose all reason and all logic, and you're going to do something stupid, and you're going to do something you regret later. Don't do it. When you start getting emotional, bring it down. Withdraw, if you have to, until you can get yourself together. The other should not respond with a smart remark when that happens. If your spouse comes in and says, you know what, I'm getting really agitated about this, you know, this is really getting on my nerves, or however you express all that, it's important that the other spouse keep their dumb mouth shut and don't provoke it. Because now you're picking a conflict, now you're picking a fight, and it don't go anywhere. Kids need to learn that. If you're old enough to argue, you're old enough to learn when to keep your dumb mouth shut. Quit poking at something. Quit provoking people. The Bible says, provoke not your brother to wrath, and that includes marriage. So, if you can wait a while and talk it over later, find something else to do, and immediately withdraw from the source of irritation, let each spouse protect the other. When they sense arousing anger in each other, let each spouse slow down the rapid fire speech and the lower screaming voice and allow the flaming heat of anger to cool down. There's one thing, if I've ever have been allowed to be the head of my house from time to time, there's one thing that I've never liked. It didn't happen much in the home that I grew up in with my parents. It hardly ever happened, and that's shouting at each other. You know, we don't have a farm tractor running in the middle of the living room. I can hear just fine. I don't need for you to shout at me for me to hear you. And your shouting at me will only provoke me to want to shout back. And it accomplishes nothing. As a matter of fact, I think it makes a pretty big fool out of you, especially when your kids come in and say, would y'all be quiet? We're trying to do homework in here. Can y'all calm it down a little bit? It gets kind of embarrassing when that happens. But bottom line, when you get angry with your spouse or even your kids, your anger will take you to an emotional peak where you're not reasonable nor logical anymore, and you'll do something you'll regret. You'll say something, you'll call a name, you'll bring up a memory, whatever. There should be no loss of ego or status in a marital relationship when one spouse says, I'm sorry to the other, or forgive me to the other. It's usually as painful to the person who is being asked as it is to the asker. And it's the law of the Lord to always forgive. So the next thing I want to talk to you about, and I'm just about done. May not get into the headship and the submission thing. But the second thing in marriage that crops up, the negative emotion, is fear. Fear was the initial negative emotion found in the Bible after Adam and Eve sinned. As a matter of fact, it's the first negative emotion that was manifested in the Bible. For the first time, man was afraid of the God who made him and loved him, as Brother Ben so adequately demonstrated here tonight. Fear causes the same tensions as anger and is responsible. The medical world says that fear is responsible for some 51 physical ailments. There's over 51 physical ailments that can be caused by fear alone. It affects your emotional system, your nervous system. It can affect weight. It can affect the way you eat, the whole thing. Fear is not usually caused by a single experience, but becomes a habitual lifestyle. And fearful people worry about almost anything that is new and different. A fearful person will inhibit himself vocationally, socially, educationally, and even intimately. His or her family and his or her spiritual life will suffer greatly because of fear. Fear will stifle conversation. Fear stifles communication. Fear is a horrible emotion, and it must be dealt with. Fears are reaction that we must not allow to conquer and to control us, although certain basic temperaments are more fear-prone than others. So fear must be conquered. Let me have about 3 minutes, and I'll be done. We've talked to you about anger and fear. I want to talk to you just for about 3 minutes about decision-making in a marriage. Our culture says that a marital relationship needs to be 50-50. The Bible don't teach that. It doesn't. I did teach last Wednesday night that husband and wife, male, female, they're not equal, but they are equivalent in purpose. They're not equals, they are equivalent in purpose. I know our society's driving this everybody's equal kind of thing. It doesn't say that one's not as valuable as the other, and I don't mean to imply that, but they have equal purpose, of equal weight, of equal priority, of equal necessity. Homes without a dad and homes without a mom are not complete. They're just not. The Bible intended for the man to have a role and the woman to have a role. And there's some intertwine in that, and then there's other things. There's none. There's no mixing of the two. So when you get married and want to have a successful marriage, it can begin with mutual agreement. And I think when people especially want to get married, there's some things you need to agree on. You need to agree on spirituality. You need to agree on convictions, on Bible convictions, on the plan of salvation and lifestyle and all that kind of stuff. If you don't, there's going to be some problems. There's going to be some conflict right off the bat. So there needs to be some mutual agreement. These things need to be discussed. You need to discuss money. You need to discuss compatibility. If he likes toast and you only like biscuits, you've got a conflict. Unless you want to get up every morning and make both. Not being silly here tonight, but these kind of things can drive a marriage apart. Yes, they can. It's the little things. She wants the bed made every morning. He don't care. He don't care if the bathroom's clean. She does. All these kind of things cause conflict. And you, marriage is not reform school. You're not going to change them. And if he lived in a home where everybody was a slob, he's going to be a slob in his new house. He's going to leave his boots in the middle of the living room floor. He's going to drop his underwear anywhere and expect you to pick them up. Hello? It's not reform school. You marry this dude and that's what you get. You marry this girl and that's what you get. And we all try to make each other happy at first, but when the honeymoon's over. So the principle of submitting to each other in a marriage is similar to the pattern of submissiveness between the members of the body of Christ. And there are times in the body when it is appropriate for one another to exercise leadership over other members. Sometimes that's appropriate. We have serve team leaders here. I asked Sister Ethel Tier to be our serve team leader, our children's coordinator, administrator over our Sunday school and kids ministry on Wednesday night. She does a phenomenal job with that. And it works because she takes that role as head, and the children's staff that work with her submit to that. And they do what she asks them to do. And they don't do what she asks them not to do. And it works. So it's similar. Does it mean somebody's more important than the other? It just means there's a mutual agreement that I'm going to submit to my head. So another example is no single spiritual gift automatically qualifies a member to be the leader or ultimate decision maker. all of the time. The Bible doesn't teach that. That position belongs to the head, which in this case would be Jesus himself. So likewise, marriage, the role of decision-making is not assigned according to some decree from God or on the basis of maleness or femaleness, but on the basis of mutual agreement. There's things that we agree on. And we go into our marriage with mutual agreement and mutual understanding about some things. When you have that understanding, you have a whole lot better chance of a successful, healthy, happy marriage. The skill of a Christian marriage lies in the negotiation and assignment of these leadership roles on the basis of each partner's ability. But then the Bible talks about, not only is there mutual agreement, but there's also the headship of the husband. I love the story of the fellow whose wife chased him under the bed, beating him with the broom. And she chased him under the bed. She got down on her hands and knees and looked on that bed and said, "You come out from under that bed right now." And he said, "I'm the man of the house. I'll come out when I'm ready." There is the husband's headship. In the marriage, the husband has the office of head of the house. Listen to Pastor. When the husband doesn't do that properly, you're asking for conflict. If you do it biblically, it'll work. If the wife will do her part, it'll work. This simply means he has the responsibility and authority to guide the marriage. If he faithfully exercises his office, both he and his wife will be free to them to be themselves. As the head, the husband is called to take the lead in mutually examining the marriage to see if it's developing according to its long-range goals. That's his job. Clearly, headship is not being a boss. The husband can only command the wife to live up to what the two of them mutually
pledged when they were married.
So likewise, if the husband neglects his office, the wife ought to discreetly remind him of their mutual vows. "Honey, you agreed. We had this agreement." So neither does headship imply inferiority or superiority. Rather, headship is a special office of service so that marriage may thrive and grow. Headship does not mean that the husband leads or decides in every detail. Once a man and woman have agreed on what their respective involvement will be in various decision areas, they can leave these decisions to the partner with the appropriate talents, temperament, and opportunity. The husband's role is to be on guard continually so that little things do not develop into the kind of patterns that undermine the entire marriage. And this is where, when I'm counseling with people, 9 times out of 10, the marital issue boils down to the fact that the husband is not serving in his role of headship and or the wife is not submitting to it. So I believe it's imperative when you get married that you have some understanding of what each person's role is going to be. Now, I know men, that says absolutely the man needs to be in control of all the money. He needs to take care of the checkbook and all that kind of stuff. I don't want to do all that. And I am blessed that I found someone to marry that does. So we agreed when we got married that she would take care of the checkbook. So I'm a nice little husband. When I get paid, I just hand her my check. Actually, I don't even see a check anymore. I haven't seen a check. I've gotten paid, and I don't know when. She just deposits every month, and I assume all that's good. Our lights are still burning and water's still running, so I assume everything's good. But we had that agreement, you understand. We had that. Now, if she just walked in all of a sudden and said, "Here, I don't want to do this no more," I'm going to flounder a little bit because she's done that for 41 years. And so whatever you set up and you understand, you stick to that role. But overall, I believe it's the husband's job to make sure his home is well spiritually, domestically, financially, and so on. It's your job to do that. And the wife needs to be aware of that. So I want to throw that little bit right there at the end of this, and then next week we'll move on to something else. So, are y'all getting anything out of this? I'm going to tell you, it's well attended. The Wednesday night crowds have been amazing, and I deeply, deeply appreciate all of y'all being here on Wednesday night. In conclusion tonight, in this dismissal, I really believe the Lord has been challenging me on a huge level I've been preaching my heart out for the past number of Sundays, and I believe God, right here in the middle of summertime, God wants to yank our church and move in a direction for growth and just some great things to happen. I believe some great things, amazing things are coming down the pike. I want to encourage you to be here on Sunday. I know we have a lot of people vacationing, and I'm into that. Go and have a great time and come back refreshed and just come back better. I told somebody that today. I said, man, you going on vacation? Yeah, well, just come back better. And they said, how? I'm like, stop it. Everybody has room for improvement. Anyway, but I'm into that. But right in the middle of summer, God has chosen to talk to my heart in a drastic way, in a great way. I need your prayers. I love it, your prayer. And I would really appreciate you being here to help me move Grace Church in the direction God is wanting it to go. So that being said, Lord willing, we'll see y'all Sunday morning at 10 o'clock for Sunday school and 11 o'clock for our worship service. God bless you tonight. Can you be dismissed from the sitting down position, or do you need to stand up to do that? It's hard, I know, but you're dismissed. So get up and go walk around and talk to people before you go home. God bless you tonight.